I'm Jenny Luckett. This is Pacific University's Boxer Voices. This is our first episode of Boxer Voices, a new project to record some of the memories of Pacific University alumni and students. Today we're talking with Wid Blything. Wid is a retired optometrist and colonel in the U.S. Air Force, as well as the former dean of the Pacific University College of Optometry. Before that, though, Wid was a student here. He arrived as a freshman in 1947 and found himself on a college campus full of older GIs just back from World War II.
There were different dynamics as a result of that kind of thing. At home, they went home and I lived in university apartments on the edge of the campus that was near what was then the football field. And these were kind of rickety little places that had been put together as leftover buildings from Camp Adair down near Corvallis. And the government gave them to universities who could make use of them. And we made good use of those. But they lived there as families, and many of them had a spouse and children to go home to. The rest of us went to McCormick Hall. And so the divide was obvious in terms of age, but in terms of where you were in life at the time. So that meant when you had homecoming activities where it was going to be a noise parade, it was the rah-rah kids from 19-year-olds that were really in there. Freshman hazing didn't seem to apply to the GI. They thought that was too childish for them. They just plain didn't cooperate. So that left the football team with fewer targets. Us freshmen with our green beanies. The social life on campus was primarily driven by the Greek organizations, and I was a member of Gamma, and it was the oldest. In fact, it was older than many national fraternities. During that time, they actually acquired a house in Porch Grove. It became the Gamma House that originally was built for the Alpha Zeta fraternity. They went broke, turned into the Porch Grove Hospital for a while, and then back again. And everybody was quite sure it would be the place for beer parties. Actually, they were so overcorrective of that that they had allowed no alcohol in the building at all. And so that was not an issue. You had to dress up for dinner each evening, and each six tables had upperclassmen at the head of the table, and you were fined for poor manners or saying the wrong thing. And so it was all about turning people into gentlemen scholars, I guess is the right word. And one of our biggest champions against the dean of students, who was very suspicious, was a professor of religion named Gertrude Crane. And she was a tough old lady who said, "Nonsense, these are good kids, leave them alone." And many did. It was a good time for Pacific because we had more students than we knew what to do with them in terms of housing and classroom and stuff like that. So it was a bit of bonanza in terms of enrollment, but not without its other challenges as well because of the two different cultures being melded together. The veterans were good students and they were serious about it, and the vast majority were studying optometry, not other majors. And I think they got a good value for their GI Bill for doing that. They were often officers who had been pilots, navigators. That was common, it seemed. That meant they had strong backgrounds in engineering. Everyone had a slide rule slinging from their belt. And so when you sat in physics class, it was a little disarming to have this person sitting on each side of you and you didn't have your slide rule. And they were whizzes at that thing. And so they could solve these physics and math problems at great speed. I remember I was majoring in optometry, and you did that as a freshman on. One of the requirements was a course called math analysis. and it was taught by a crusty little lady, Andrea. And the first day the class met, there weren't enough seats in the room to hold the group. The second day it met, there were empty seats. She scared the pants off of that many students with the first lecture, and most of these were the GIs, it turned out, who weren't ready for beginning calculus, that's for sure. That was an interesting period, but as it melded in, the U.S. was in the period of time called the Korean conflict. They careful not to use war because we had never declared war technically. So it was called the Korean conflict. I was eligible for selective service. And so every male had to register, had to take a physical exam and the like. And so if you were in college pursuing successfully a college curriculum, you could get deferred. You had to stay in the top 10% of your class to be eligible. That's a good incentive, I would say. And so I managed to do that, and I found out that my technical/engineering background in high school, 4 years of math, 4 years of science, played very well as a background to study optometry. You know, I had taken a year of physics, I had taken a year of chemistry, and 4 years of math, and this type of thing, and it brought a very solid background. I stayed in that calculus course. I didn't walk out the first day, and that's why. So now I'm being deferred from a selective service, and I finished my OD degree. I got a bachelor's degree, I finished my OD degree, and I don't feel like I'm done yet. Besides, all my classmates are a lot older than I am. I'd like to be smart like them and a little older like them. So I decided to stay 2 more years and do a graduate degree, a master's science degree. And at that time, it was a brand new program that allowed us to do clinical type majors. So I chose children's vision, which has been sort of my specialty and passion. It was wonderful. So I was teaching in the daytime, going to school at night, and one night a week I had off and I sang in the Forest Grove Gleeman. It was like a breath of fresh air. Now I've finished a master's degree. I'm really eligible now for selective service. And so I go down and visit with him. There was a second act passed in the meantime called the draft doctor's law. I was eligible for both of those. So I knew I needed to get my service time out of the way. It was how I did it was important to me. If I was selective service, I went ended up in the infantry. Didn't matter what I studied in college. I didn't really want to do that if I could do the other. During that time, Senator McCarthy was making everybody out to be a communist. And so I was going to be teaching top secret stuff, and I had to have a top secret clearance before they would give me a commissioned position. The Air Force was not going to be embarrassed by this in any fashion. It takes a long time. So I'm working pickup jobs and like that in offices around, just trying to fill in. For several weeks, I was substitute music teacher in the Portland Public Schools. Okay, teaching band. So I'm a music teacher now. I'm trying to make a little bucks here and there, and working in other optometry offices in there, waiting for the FBI to clear me for a top secret clearance. My neighbor says, "Are you in trouble? The FBI was asking about you today." No, I'm okay.
When the approval finally came through, Wid was stationed at the School of Aviation Medicine, a part of the Air University headquarters in Montgomery, Alabama. He was teaching other military personnel how to care for patients in the field. The work was rewarding, he said, but Alabama in the 1950s was a different world for him.
The biggest adjustment for me was, here was a guy who had grown up in Portland in the Northwest and in a family that was taught that people are created equal and should be treated that way. And during my years at Pacific, had a black roommate for several years, ended up in a state where segregation was prevalent. It was very hard for me to get used to that. I wasn't used to seeing restrooms, men, women, colored. Drinking fountains, colored. Reception rooms in a medical office, white, colored. And the Ku Klux Klan was still very much in evidence, especially in those states. And so they would have a rally, and you would walk down the street and pass a Klansman in all his garb. I had a hard time with that. And I learned at the time it wasn't just black people, it was Jewish people, Catholic people that they had as targets. And I did some practice with, some weekend practice with a local optometrist who happened to be Jewish. And we would go to lunch together and pass one of these people on the street, and you could just feel him tighten up until we went past that situation. I was kind of fascinated by the culture there, and on weekends I would take and drive out in the country and visit little country churches that were mainly black churches. I would tell my colleagues in the choir what I'd done on a weekend, you can't go there, that's a black area. You can't go to that market, that's a black market. And I thought, I said, that's your problem, it's not mine. They felt it was too dangerous to be hanging around. I would, being interested in music, I would sometimes go park my car in front of a black church on Sunday night and listen to them sing. It was just something else. When they sang, the whole world just rocks. It was terrific. I end up being the choir director at a Methodist church. And across the street and down a block was another church, a Baptist church, and the minister's name was Martin Luther King. So I was there during the bus boycott, the Rosa Parks thing. I was utterly amazed at the degree of peaceful organizational talents displayed by Martin Luther King. If the bus isn't going to run, we'll run our own system. So you'd see station wagons stop at a church, pick up a bunch of people, all take them to work. Didn't need the bus. The bus is run by the city. They didn't have people paying passengers, they started to go broke because there was nobody riding the bus. I can't think of a better tactic than to get to the city through their pocketbook. It really worked. It really worked. That was kind of a growing up thing for me, sociologically. See how that existed, and to be there during the heavy pulse of its changing and witnessing things on the street that were happening and stuff like that.
Thanks for listening to this first episode of Pacific University Boxer Voices. You can find more stories about boxers in military service online and in print in our summer 2016 issue of Pacific Magazine. And look for future installments of Boxer Voices online at pacificu.edu. We'd love to share your story next. If you have an idea for a future episode, email us at news@pacificu.edu.